This is Jeff Blankfort. Christine Ahn is the founder and international coordinator of Women Cross DMZ, a global movement of women mobilizing for peace in Korea. She's also co-founder of the Korea Policy Institute and Korea Peace Network. She's participated and led several peace and solidarity trips to South and North Korea, has addressed the UN, Congress, the National Human Rights Commission in South Korea, and has written articles for many journals, been interviewed widely on major media. And we reached her this morning in Hawaii. Christine Ahn, welcome to Takes on the World.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's a great pleasure. I have heard you interviewed elsewhere, and I really wanted to get you here. And so it has happened at a very propitious time. Last week, Steve Bannon made a remarkable statement in an interview with Robert Kuttner, the American Prospect, in which he said that that there was no military solution to the U.S.-North Korea standoff, and suggested the best solution would be for the 30,000 U.S. troops to be withdrawn in exchange for a verifiable freeze in North Korea's nuclear weapons program. That apparently was what led him to be fired. This seems such a reasonable suggestion, coming from someone who I don't consider to be very reasonable, but what was your take on that, your reaction when you read it?
It was unbelievable to read that there was somebody who wielded so much influence in the White House to even have those ideas was incredible. And, you know, I think the main takeaway from that interview, yes, there was the whole bit about North Korea, but was about the economic war against China. And that, to me, has always, aligned with the way that I view the U.S. Approach to North Korea is the real target is China, and North Korea is a boogeyman that justifies further intensifying military operations, more bases, more missile defense systems. You know, the latest one is the THAAD missile defense system deployed in South Korea. That has nothing to do with stopping a North Korean missile from striking South Korea. It has everything to do with preventing a North Korean missile from striking U.S. territories or eventually the U.S. mainland. So I thought it was an incredible statement. And, while that would be a great thing for the U.S. to eventually leave the Korean Peninsula, there have been other demands that the North Koreans have made, namely that they need a peace settlement, because the Korean War never officially ended. There has always just been a ceasefire that was signed in 1953 that halted the war, but has basically maintained a state of war on the Korean Peninsula for 70 years. And they would like improved economic, they want normalized relations, because they are under the heaviest sanctions of any country in the world, which was kind of offset a bit during the Cold War, when North Korea had, active trading in the socialist trading bloc. But once the Soviet Union collapsed, that trading bloc no longer existed. And so the U.S., as the world superpower, really put its choke on North Korea. And then, fortunately, with the rise of China's economy, they've been able to stabilize. But still, that country is nowhere that it can be. I mean, given that if you look at the trajectory of North and South Korea's economic development following the war, which both sides, but North Korea was far worse devastated. I mean, 80% of North Korean cities were completely bombed to death under the U.S. Scorched Earth campaign. But if you actually look at their economic development, North Korea far outpaced South Korea up until the 1980s. When I would go into North Korea, you would see that there were, it was like the infrastructure, it was like a modern industrialized country that had basically like the plug from the electricity had been pulled, and there were a few cars on the road. Electricity was very difficult. I mean, very similar to people that have visited Cuba can understand. So the economic relations, the peace settlement. They just want some kind of normalized agreement with the United States, which they view as, having a hostile policy towards them that includes regime change and trying to prevent their country from being a sovereign nation.
Well, it's interesting. Yesterday's New York Times had an article from Seoul by a man, Cho Jong-hoon, in which he was talking about the opinions of people in South Korea. And he said, ask people in the South whether the North will ever abandon its arsenal. And more often than not, the answer is, would you if you were North Korean? I mean, it's something that Americans are so ignorant about the war. I mean, I grew up during that period, and I was a little more knowledgeable than most. But today in the schools, it's called the Forgotten War. And so earlier, before I called you, I went through some of the statistics, some comments of what people at the time had made about the total destruction of Korea, a country that North Korea, which had never threatened the United States or never attacked the United States, and compared it actually with our subsequent war in Vietnam. In neither case were reparations ever discussed or offered, or was any pressure from this country. And there was an anti-Vietnam War movement, as there was not during the Korean War. But there was no ever the idea, discussion of providing reparations for the destruction that our military caused.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, there's still so much unearthing that needs to happen. I mean, not just even during the Korean War, but in the aftermath. And, I think part of the there's so many things. You bring up Choi Sang-hoon, who is the New York Times reporter. And before he joined the New York Times, he was with the Associated Press. And he, along with two other journalists, Charles Hanley and Martha Mendoza, won the Pulitzer Prize at the AP for their groundbreaking journalism on No Gunry. It was a bridge. It was on the southern side. And these civilians went to No Gunry dressed in white as civilians so that they weren't caught in the crossfire of U.S. bombs that were flying, across the peninsula. And this was when, during the Korean War, when the North Koreans had advanced south, but then the U.S., pushed them back up north. And, it's still so much confusion for a lot of the civilians that are trying not to get in any of the crossfire. But it later turned out that these civilians were massacred, and these three AP reporters, which includes Choi Sang-hoon, who now is at the Times, interviewed a lot of the U.S. soldiers that were in charge of that unit for shooting the civilians in No Gunry, and followed basically the chain of command. And they got to the very top, and there was a missing memo from the archives that showed deliberate, message, which was, doesn't matter whether they're civilians or not. They could be communists, so just kill them all. That was basically the message. And so, that period from during the Korean War and then afterwards, because in the South, very similar to what we see in Iraq or Afghanistan, the U.S. appointed a puppet president, Lee Seung-man, who hadn't lived on the Korean Peninsula for decades, and who was married to a Norwegian woman. And so they came to kind of lead the country. There was a coup, a democratic overthrow, and for a little bit there was democratic rule. And then the dictator, Park Chung-hee, who had been trained by the Japanese during the colonial period, took over in a coup, and South Korea remained under dictatorship for, 20 years. And that happened to be the father of the former president, Park Geun-hye, who recently was impeached by Candlelight Revolution. of the Korean people. And, you know, it's just, I think so much of the inability to also forget the Korean War has so much to do with South Korea being under, also under dictatorship, and repressing some of the atrocious massacres and the kind of wholesale killing of leftists and people that weren't even communists. I mean, you look at a situation like Jeju Island, where in 1948, the people rose up because they didn't want to have separate elections. And basically, they used that as an opportunity, the U.S. military government, so the South Korean government backed by the U.S. military, basically waged a massacre on that island. It's an island off the coast of Korea. And, you know, almost 50% of the people of that island were massacred by a scorched earth and also, like, you know, these youth gangs going in to kill them. And, you know, so much of this is because there has been repression. And I think that in the period of the 2000s, when Kim Dae-jung, who was the Sunshine Policy president who came into power and was truly the first democratically elected president, he, you know, began a process of reconciliation, not only with North Korea, but within South Korea, to start to release some of those stories. And so I guess back to the thing about the forgotten war, it has a lot to do with America's amnesia and wanting to forget the fact that we lost such a huge war. There was an impasse. The U.S., it was the first war that the U.S. did not win. We were obviously victors in World War II. And starting with the Korean War began the U.S. subsequent failures in military interventions. So I think that's part of it. And I think it also has to do with South Korea being under successive dictatorships. And because of the dictatorship's close alliance with the United States, you know, censoring some of that brutal, traumatic history.
Well, those South Korean dictatorships did not seem to bother Washington as what was happening in the North. I know one other thing that I mentioned in my introductory remarks before I called you, which I had mentioned in another program before, was I cited an article by a former British Foreign Service official, John Pratt, about the origins of the war, in which he cited information that, in fact, it was the South that had launched the war and the North had retaliated. And he even cited former historian John Gunther, who was told that at the time by an American official in Tokyo. And I know this question is still not here, but up in the air there. But do people in North Korea believe that it was the South that started the war?
Yes.
Because
they do.
Yeah.
And even I.F. Stone, who we know is
right.
an incredible journalist, and he wrote a book called The Hidden History of the Korean War that he could not get published anywhere in the United States and even in the UK. And fortunately, because the Monthly Review Press had just opened up, that was their first book they published. Otherwise, that the level of censorship was so thick that even that perspective cannot even be introduced into U.S. media, into U.S. public consciousness. Yes, I mean, and, you know, it's not just the North Koreans that view that, but, you know, a lot of Korean War historians, Korean historians that go through, that look at newspaper articles, you know, there was lobbying back and forth. You know, there were shots that were fired across. And, you know, I mean, I'm not an expert on that period, but from what I have read and what I've heard from other Korean historians is that the war didn't exactly start on June 25th, 1950, that there were actually incursions that were taking place back and forth, but it was June 25th happened to be the day that the North Koreans crossed over the 38th parallel. Which then, quote unquote, became the official start of the Korean War. But many, you know, and many estimate that you know, North Korea did that because they had heard or they had obviously witnessed the strikes that had come across from the south, that there was going to be a, you know, an advance from the south to the north. And so maybe it was a countermeasure. I mean, we can get stuck on this forever, and obviously knowing the truth is important, but it has obviously still not served to end this ongoing conflict. And what we try to do at Women Across DMZ is to try to move the conversation forward and talk about other aspects of this conflict besides the potential threat of nuclear war that would kill us all. But what about the families that remain divided? What about the cost of repression on both sides of the DMZ? You know, what are the huge costs that we aren't really acknowledging when we look at the maintaining the state of war? And, you know, I don't know if you knew this, Jeff, but I recently traveled to South Korea. I first had gone to China, but as I was checking in at the airport, and there's a New York Times article about this, but as I was checking in at SFO to go to Shanghai, the plane was stopping in Incheon in Seoul, and I could not board that plane. The Aegean ticket agent told me that I was denied entry into South Korea, and I just, I was flabbergasted because I was born in Seoul, and I'm a peace activist, and they said, yeah, we're really sorry to tell you this, but that's what the government has informed us, that I have been on a no-fly list. And, it, you know, I mean, I quickly went to United and I bought an airline ticket to go to Shanghai. But in the meantime, I actually called that guy, Choi Sang-hoon, the New York Times reporter, to tell him what had happened. And it turned out, and you know, I was informed that the new Moon administration would reverse the ban in 48 hours, but I was put on that travel ban by Park Geun-hye, who was the former daughter of that dictator I mentioned, who wanted a very hard-line stance against North Korea. And as retribution for the peace walks that I organized in 2015 of women peacemakers across the DMZ. But that's the kind of repression. I mean, you know, I'm just one person. Obviously, they have a choice whether they, as a U.S. citizen, they want to allow into their country or not. But, you know, that action is part of a larger effort by that government to, she had a blacklist of 10,000 artists, writers, filmmakers. In fact, the most famous filmmaker in South Korea was put on this blacklist that they weren't not only allowed to receive government contracts for funding, they were basically smeared as being pro-North. So that's the way in which this unresolved Korean War still gets played out. I mean, obviously in the North, the regime will use it to justify maintaining the kind of political system that it maintains. But also in the South, where we consider it to be a free and open democracy, it is used still to charge people for being pro-North, pro-communist, you know, labor unionists, peace activists, you know, you name it. It's the Cold War still lives on. And so that's why we've been pushing for a peace treaty because, and, you know, this is the first president, Moon Jae-in in South Korea, who has called for a peace treaty. And I think that has everything to do with the fact that even though South Korea was not an official, quote-unquote, signatory to the Armistice Agreement, which was the ceasefire that temporarily halted the war, it was actually the U.S., on behalf of the UN command that included South Korea, the DPRK, and China. Those were the three military leaders that signed the Armistice Agreement with a promise within 90 days to return to peace talks to finalize a peace settlement. And but Moon Jae-in, he had worked as the chief of staff with the last liberal president 10 years ago, Yoon Mui-hyun. And he knew that Yoon Mui-hyun had tried so much to promote inter-Korean reconciliation, but that also coincided with the Bush administration that had put North Korea on the axis of evil, that had basically tore apart the agreed framework, which the Clinton administration had negotiated with North Korea to freeze its nuclear program in exchange for these light water reactors and heavy fuel. So, you know, it's a long history that repeats itself. And so we're, again, in that situation where we have a pro-engagement president in South Korea, Moon Jae-in, who is dealing with an unhinged neocon in the White House. And so, you know, it's complicated.
Well, Christine, on how much real power does Moon Jae-in have in terms of the South Korean military? Today, or Monday, they began 11 days of joint exercises between the United States military and the South Korean military. The New York Times reported that it was to practice defending against attack from North Korea, but it's obviously not that. But how much power does Moon Jae-in actually have when it comes to issues of war and peace?
That's a great question, Jeff. I mean, South Korea still maintains kind of a clientelistic relationship with the United States. Not only is the U.S. owns, basically controls wartime operational control. So right now, if they were to go to war with North Korea, that U.S. is making the shots. And certainly they have some kind of discussion, but if the U.S. is, then it's the U.S. that will basically make the decision. And that's where Moon Jae-in is trying to wrangle back that power and that transfer back into the hands of South Korea. U.S. obviously wields significant economic and political influence. It's been that way. I think it's difficult. I take, for example, I don't know if you know about the comfort women issue, but those were about 200,000 sex slaves for the Japanese military. And, you know, in 2015, this is during the Obama administration, they wanted to, as part of its U.S. pivot to Asia and its efforts to contain and encircle China, they want to strengthen the trilateral alliance of the U.S., South Korea, and Japan, and that means improving the surveillance communication and military exercises. And basically, if Japan was striked, that the South Korean troops would basically go in to help Japan, which, you know, for any Korean, it's like, really? And this is a country that invaded Korea and colonized Korea. So, you know, it obviously went completely against the will and the desire of the Korean people, but basically that president at the time, Park Geun-hye, was going along with it in support of the U.S. trilateral alliance, even though it was against the wishes of their own people. And as part of kind of greasing the oil or, like, removing the obstacles towards that path of improving the alliance, trilateral alliance, she agreed to negotiate a bilateral agreement with Japan, basically forgiving Japan about the comfort women issue without a formal apology. And basically Japan would, and not even Japan, the government, but like some private foundation would give each of the remaining like grandmothers like $80,000 or something and just say, okay, that's it, you know. And it was just a huge slap in the face to these women and to their supporters who have been organizing and protesting weekly outside of the Japanese embassy. And, you know, they've installed these statues now of these, even one in San Francisco is being installed, but, you know, bronze statue of a girl, you know, sitting and waiting for an apology. And it was obviously part of the entire country's resentment towards Park Geun-hye that ultimately led to her overthrow. I think that's a good example of how much power the U.S. wields over South Korea.
Well, it was interesting, and I commented at the time when in the period before the election, leading up to the elections, the U.S. had installed the THAAD missile as if what the Korean people desired was of no relevance to what was going on in Washington. And it was obviously that the THAAD was not intended, as you mentioned earlier, would not defend Seoul against any kind of an attack. It was, this is why the Chinese have objected to it. Getting back to China, we constantly hear that China has to do this, China has to do that. And it's interesting that China did vote along with Russia at the Security Council for very, very tough sanctions on North Korea. And I interpreted the Russian vote because of the friendship or the desire of Putin to stay on the good side of Trump. But why would China support those sanctions, or are they just going to observe them, pay lip service to them? What do you think that's going to happen with that?
I think it's a good question. I, too, was wondering why that was the case. And I think it also has to do with kind of trading horses. China did it as a way to, I think, both temper the United States, which, you know, they have, you know, just as all of us have seen all sorts of provocative statements coming from the Trump administration. And, you know, earlier this spring, the U.S. has called Vincent heading to the Korean waters. And so there is this kind of all options are on the table, including a maximum pressure, including a military option. So I think that that's one reason, is to try to diffuse that by saying, let's give, you know, this other, instead of a military option, let's try these other approaches. And I think it was to try, you know, because they are in some kind of economic warfare with the United States, to try to stave that off. You know, these things are never just as they seem, but obviously there's some back channel dealings that the U.S. offered to China to get them to sign on to it. And, you know, I mean, I think the part about the lip service is also true. I mean, it's difficult to monitor that. And as many experts have noted, is, you know, despite already pretty heavy sanctions against North Korea, they managed to get around them. And I think that's what people that are really closed off from the traditional or, you know, economy, that's why people engage in black markets. And so I think North Korea is definitely king of black markets and figuring out ways to get around them. It is not, let's just say the point is that these sanctions have not worked in terms of stopping North Korea from advancing its nuclear missile program. What it has done is it's harmed the country's ability to improve their economy. I mean, despite that, what we have seen is, you know, there is rapid development in North Korea. You know, there's new buildings, there's new museums, there's new water parks. There's far more, many more cars on the road. I mean, when I was there 2 years ago, I saw things that I hadn't seen, you know, in years, like vendors and taxis and people carrying cell phones. I mean, you know, despite all of those sanctions, it seems that people are faring better.
Well,
it's still hard.
The image Americans have of South Korea is apparently very, very different from the reality. I recently saw a video of filming in South Korea, in North Korea, rather, and the images of what you see in the North are diametrically opposed to the image as presented on the printed page here or by our political pundits. But nevertheless, they are moving ahead with advancing their ballistic missiles program. And today, the New York Times reported that earlier today, North Korea state media released a photograph suggesting that the North is working on a more powerful solid-fuel ballistic missile. And said the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, had ordered the production of more rocket engines and warheads. And the solid-fuel missiles do not have to be loaded with fuel just before launching. So this would be an even more of an advance in the program. Where do you see this going?
Yeah. I don't know. It's so difficult because also, I mean, what we read in the papers yesterday was that Tillerson saying that, you know, he's, you know, like basically patting the North Koreans on the back. Oh, well, you haven't tested any missiles for the last 2 weeks. And, you know, maybe there's room for talk. And then on the other hand, you hear, you know, the other side of within the administration about preventive war, and all options are on the table. And even in response to the Bannon interview with Kuttner, you know, that they got us. There's no military option, like the joint command, and Mattis and Tillerson both coming out to say. So, that administration, it's so hard to read because even within the administration, we have people saying we are not having regime change. That is not our policy. And then somebody like Mike Pompeo from the CIA saying that is our policy. So you have totally diametrically opposing views. So just imagine from the North Koreans' point of view, what the heck is going on there? And then you also have, you know, these military exercises that are taking place that, you know, we say is just for defense and it's just, you know, routine. Well, that might be so in the eyes of a legal Western framework, but from the North Koreans' point of view, they say, okay, so what is the difference with our missile and nuclear program? It's routine from our point of view, and it's in defense. And so these military exercises that include from the operation plan, decapitation includes flying of B-1, B-2 bombers, like right along the border, southern border with the North. It involves like simulating surgical strikes on their nuclear reactors. I mean, how is that just routine and not an act of aggression towards North Korea, and just the way that we view North Korea's missile and nuclear program as an act of aggression? So, you know, the most viable proposal on the table to begin talks is one that was first introduced by the North Koreans but has backing of the Chinese and Russians, is a freeze for a freeze, which is, okay, let's freeze North Korea's nuclear missile program in exchange for freezing these exercises. The exercises have been frozen during the Clinton administration, and they can be done again. And even Moon Jae-in, the new South Korean president, one of his senior presidential advisors, had actually flown to Washington, D.C. to float the idea with the Trump administration a week before the Moon-Trump summit took place in June, and unfortunately was not well received. But we do know from that act that Moon Jae-in would seriously consider it. And, you know, Moon Jae-in does not want, and he has made that very forceful statement, that there will not be a war on the Korean Peninsula while he is president. And so that's why we need, you know, calls like this. That's why we need actions that are taking place across the country right now. Today in Boston, there's going to be a big rally, No Fire, No Fury, peace talks now, you know, calling for an end to this brinkmanship and the beginning of talk.
Curious, where is this? Is the South Korean labor movement, which has always been strong on this issue, are they out front? Are they active on this, or are they divided in South Korea?
No, I think that they're pretty. There's a range of different trade unions, but the Korean Confederation of Trade Unions, the more progressive one, is definitely. I think they've been out and supporting the protests against the THAAD missile defense system. And, you know, I would say that there's a pretty broad cross-section of South Korean society that, you know, is against these military exercises and the missile defense system. You know, and that definitely jives with the late polls that show that 8 in 10 South Koreans want inter-Korean dialogue. They want inter-Korean reconciliation. They don't want to maintain that hardline policy of Park Geun-hye and Lee Myung-bak, the two presidents before Moon Jae-in. And so I think that that is a strong sentiment of the people of South Korea that, you know, this is enough. And it's time to figure out a way to live in coexistence, peaceful coexistence.
Is there any talks that you're aware of that are going on low level between the North and the South that are kind of unofficial at the moment?
You know, unfortunately, Moon Jae-in has had, similarly to the Trump administration, has two faces. And on the one hand, he's calling for a peace treaty, he's made offers of talks with North Korea to discuss military talks and to begin family reunions and to potentially have joint athletes compete together in the Winter Olympics in Seoul next year. And unfortunately, these overtures have not been received warmly. And that has a lot to do with the fact that South Korea is going along with the Trump administration's kind of aggressive tone towards North Korea. They have, they are continuing the joint exercises, and they backed the sanctions, the UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea. And so from the North Koreans' point of view, they're saying, okay, on the one hand, you want this, but on the other hand, you're going along with this kind of hardline policy against us. And so, unfortunately, a lot of those civil society channels between the North and the South Koreans have remained closed. Certainly, they are communicating. I mean, I think, for example, there is the Christian Korean Federation in the North, along with the National Council of Churches in Korea in the South, and they have some means of communication and meeting Europe and in other places in Hong Kong, but I think that they had hoped to meet in Pyongyang in August, and they weren't able to do so. And, you know, similarly for women, the women in South Korea have expressed their desire to cross the DMZ next year, but, you know, there's no open line of communication with the North, and so that's when they depend on Women Cross DMZ to be an intermediary, interlocutor to help.
Well, we have to see. Hopefully that will happen. We've come down to the end of the hour. One quick last word for the American listeners.
Oh, well, we have a huge responsibility to help end this war. The United States divided the Korean Peninsula along with the Soviet Union. We basically tore a page out of the National Geographic and drew a line across the 38th parallel. The U.S. waged a brutal war on the Korean Peninsula, destroying 80% of the North. One in four North Koreans were killed. We have to understand that history to understand why North Korea feels the need to pursue its nuclear weapons. They look at what's happened in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, countries that had and did not have weapons of mass destruction, and they have no choice but to continue to pursue their nuclear weapons program.
And we have no choice. We have to end this hour. Thank you so much, Christine Ahn, for being our guest today on Takes on the World.
I look forward to another time. Thank you so much, Jeff.
So do we. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Jeff Blankford. Thank you for listening.